This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with David Cole and also Matthew Pegas.
Hey!
Always a pleasure.
Last time we talked in the show was about your Ann Coulter event. And since then, Ann Coulter's views on Trump have changed quite a lot. So that was back in the fall. And I guess that kind of represents the overall discontent with Trump, primarily I'd say from a lot of his original core supporters. Ironically, the people who are the most supportive of Trump now are more likely to be people, often people who would have voted, I wouldn't say not never Trumpers, but a lot of people who are supporting other candidates like Ted Cruz. And I'm sure you've noticed the same thing, but you discussed this theme in your Tacky Mag article, Twilight of the God Emperor.
Well, yes, what we're seeing right now is a reckoning. It is over 2 years into his administration, and I can't remember a candidate, and I've been around 50 years, and I've always been paying attention to politics my entire life, and I cannot remember a candidate who ran on more firmly made and specific promises. I will build a great, big, beautiful wall, and deportations day one. Now, that latter one can never be fulfilled. I mean, it wasn't fulfilled, and there's no way to make that right, because he didn't do deportations day one. The wall has not been built, has not been started on. In fact, about a week ago, Trump was here in California, in L.A. Well, he started out, though, first landed by the border, and he went to the town of Calexico. It's a California border town. And he showed off a plaque that basically said, here's where the Trump wall's going to be. Well, you know, fuck that for Trump in terms of what Trump supporters would be thinking. We don't want a plaque saying, here's where the wall's going to be. We want the wall. The plaque thing reminded me of The Wizard of Oz, where instead of giving the Scarecrow a brain, he gets a diploma. Instead of the Tin Man getting a heart, he gets a ticking clock. Those are representational items. So for people like Coulter, who supported Trump because she supported his agenda, well, once a man proves that he's not living up to his agenda, well, she's not going to support the man. She was never one of these God Emperor Trump kind of people. It's not about the guy. It's about what he's promising. And here we are, over 2 years into it. No wall, no deportations. Worse than that, within the last month alone, now this is something that Breitbart reported, within the last month alone, I think from March 2nd to April 2nd, we've released 17,000 illegal border crossers and asylum seekers into the U.S.
Yeah, I think it's the highest level of illegal immigration, much higher than either under Obama or Bush.
Yeah, exactly. And I get the feeling that Trump is not caring because I think that he's laboring under the impression that as long as the economy is good, he's going to win again, that he doesn't have to worry about rallying his base.
Or another theory, this was put out by Steve Saylor on Twitter, is that he wants to build up a massive war chest by pandering to the GOP donor base, and that's probably true as well.
Yeah, possibly, except that he already has a great deal of money, and what won him the election in 2016 was passion, not money. Hillary outspent him, and more than likely, whatever moron the Democrats put up is going to outspend him too. I don't think there is any reason other than he's smug about the fact that as long as the economy is good, he's going to win. And I made that point in my piece that the only reason that these days we say it's the economy, stupid, is because in 1992, Republicans were saying a victorious wartime president can't lose. There are always these rules. And then when Bush Sr. lost, the rule got broken, and that's when James Carville was like, nah, it ain't the war, it's the economy, stupid. And so now Trump is going to run on it's the economy, stupid. But if he doesn't have the passion among his supporters, if he cannot reignite those passionate feelings from his supporters 2 years ago, I've made this point to so many people, guys, so many people. Especially the God Emperor Trump people. Trump did not win by a large margin. Number one, he lost the popular vote, but I mean, that's attributable to California. But in the swing states, he won by 10,000, 20,000, easily reversible margins. Now, I look at 2020 not as Trump's election to win, but as the Democrats to lose. I think our best hope is the Democrats are going to run somebody incredibly bad. Coulter's point of view is that Kamala Harris, that her people are behind a lot. I mean, Biden's getting taken out. Well, Biden was probably their best bet, and Biden is getting attacked all manner of ways. Currently, Biden's being attacked because of his touchy-feeliness. A couple weeks ago, maybe 2-3 weeks ago, Biden was attacked because when he was a junior politician in Delaware, like in the 70s, he gave an interview to a local Delaware paper where he said that he was against school busing and forced integration and racial quotas. Now, that shit that he said to that Delaware newspaper is not available online. That's pure opposition research. Someone had to go to Delaware and look at microfiche of the local newspapers and comb through that stuff. This stuff doesn't happen by accident. This stuff happens because someone with money is paying people to go do this. So Biden is being taken out. The GOP establishment, and I share Coulter's opinion on this, they want Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is a big fat blob of nothing, except to the Democrats, she's something because she's a woman of color. I have no idea what Sanders is going to do in the midst of all of this. But I think Biden was their best. Now, I have a wacky theory. I'm just going to say here now, I don't necessarily think there's anything to this. I'm just going to say it so that if it happens, I can have an audio recording of me saying it. If it doesn't happen, please fucking forget I ever said it, okay? But my theory is, what if all these nothing Democrats, Beto, Harris, Booker, Gillibrand, all these. I mean, they're all just so bland and nothing.
The very middle of the road, where they kind of alienate. They have a lot of progressive talking points that alienate conservatives, yet are not actually that progressive.
Yeah, they kind of alienate both sides because they have the kind of identity politics which alienates conservatives, but they don't have the left-wing populist energy of Bernie Sanders or the other anti-establishment candidates.
And more importantly, they don't have a lot of accomplishments. I mean, Beto has zero accomplishments. Kamala Harris slept her way to the top and has practically zero accomplishments as a prosecutor. So what if they take Biden out, who is the only one with proven national appeal, and they all these morons, they just start destroying each other, and at the last minute, who jumps in? Hillary jumps in. And she comes in to save the party and save the country. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying that if I were a writer of speculative fiction, that would be my scenario. My scenario is all of these dumb shits just take themselves out of the race, destroy each other. And the woman who won the popular vote in 2016 jumps back in as the hero. Just saying, don't count that possibility out. Not saying it's going to happen, but again, just wanted to be on record saying that it might.
Yeah, as you said earlier about the energy levels, is even if the Democrats have a weak candidate, they have the energy. And with Trump, a lot of these people complaining about Trump, including Coulter, might tepidly vote for him, but there's very little energy that they're, well, I'd say like a fraction of the energy of 2016.
Yeah, because Trump can't run on build the wall anymore. He had 2 years of having a Republican Congress. Granted, a lot of those Republicans are against him. But still, what can he say needs to happen now for him to build the wall? Give me back a Republican Congress. Well, you had one, for fuck's sake.
I noticed his talking points have changed to more standard Republican talking points, so we need to cut taxes or save the country from socialism.
But I think he's doing that not so much, as Steve Saylor said, not so much in order to build a war chest. I think he's doing it because that's all that's left to him. He's doing what is still something he can say. The minute he talks about the fucking wall, everyone knows he hasn't done anything on the wall. And going to the California-Mexico border and showing off a plaque was laughable. Everyone was laughing at that. And everyone knows that the asylum seekers are coming in at greater rates. About 4 days ago, an Obama appointee judge in San Francisco struck down, or I should say put a temporary injunction on the administration's request to house some of the asylum seekers on the Mexican side of the border. So on the one issue that he made his signature issue, which was immigration, Trump has failed. All Republican, every one of those fucking candidates, from Cruz to Rubio, were all about economic growth. They were all about stop Obamacare.
Well, even as far as the economy goes and unemployment rates, one thing that Yang has been saying, Andrew Yang, is that the unemployment rates are not showing up the people who gave up searching for work or who are now on disability.
Yeah, and I the numbers are always, I mean, and Republicans would say that when Obama would claim the numbers were getting
better.
Oh, yeah,
even said that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the numbers, you either believe them or you don't. I don't know whether to believe them. I mean, it's just, it's not my, I don't, I think you can. I think maybe it's me coming from an entertainment industry background, because back in the 70s and 80s, everybody knew that the Nielsen ratings were not accurate. But TV networks needed something to be able to set advertising rates. So the Nielsens were a lie agreed upon by all the networks. Everybody knew that those Nielsen families had more than one TV, and they were watching more than just what their Nielsen box recorded. Then when VCRs came around in the 80s, and you had the ability to record one program while watching another, everybody knew that the Nielsen families were watching one thing and recording another. But it's what they call a legal fiction, like corporations being a person, or unions, trade unions being a person. It's a legal fiction. It's created to help us navigate difficult areas. Corporations are considered a person because if someone driving a Pepsi truck runs over your leg, you want to be able to sue Pepsi. If Pepsi was not seen legally as a person, you would have to sue the minimum wage Mexican driver of the truck, and he wouldn't have any money for you, or you'd have to sue every board member individually. We consider corporations a person because it makes life easier for us to do so. And same thing with the Nielsen ratings. No one believed them. No one believed they were accurate, but everyone bought into it. Networks bought into it. Advertisers bought into it. We all just sort of agreed, oh yeah, the Nielsens, the Nielsens. Well, same thing with unemployment numbers.
That strikes me as very relevant, maybe to the kind of current age in this, growing distrust in media and some of these fact reporting institutions, that these numbers that we see reflected can't always capture the real nuances of reality. Because I think Trump could point to an improving economy based on numbers about unemployment, et cetera. But at the same time, if you go to the Rust Belt areas where his promises were hoped for the most keenly, have things really gotten better there? It might not be something that the numbers can really tell us.
Yeah, because your average person, they don't care about data and statistics. They're caring about whether their personal life has improved or not.
Oh, exactly. And that's what it's going to come down to in those swing states. In Ohio and Pennsylvania.
That's the whole thing about the kind of economic conservatism is part of the reason he succeeded in winning over those working class white voters in those Rust Belt swing states, is because he moved a little bit closer to the left economically in his rhetoric. And since he's moved further to the right economically in his rhetoric, he'll have more difficulty winning those voters over.
Also, it is it is easy to play on people, on their emotions, by saying you're doing poorly. Everyone fucking thinks they're doing poorly. In other words, your average schlub wishes they were doing better. I don't know. I'm trying to think of every fucking friend I know. 99% of them wish they were doing better, whether it's they wish they were doing better in their acting profession, they wish they were doing better making ends meet economically, they wish they were doing better in their love life. Everyone wants to be doing better. So when you say to people, I know you're not doing well, but I'm going to help that. You vote for the standard, the status quo, and you're just going to keep not doing well. You come to me, and now you're going to do well. That's easy, because everybody thinks they're not doing well. Everyone wants to be doing better. Now, when you have to run on, hey, aren't you doing better? Look at me. You put me in charge, and I bet you're feeling great. Well, now you're asking for a miracle, because most people are actually not feeling great. And it doesn't even have to do with the fucking economic numbers. It doesn't even have to do with the numbers at all. It has to do with the fact that most people are unsatisfied. At any moment in their life, they're unsatisfied.
That's an interesting point. In that sense, maybe even if Trump had built the wall, et cetera, maybe just the sheer reality of his campaign, which was built on a kind of euphoria or optimism. Maybe all along he was kind of setting himself up for the sort of image.
Because if someone's a candidate, then you can project this image or fantasy into them. Well, if they're already an elected official, basically they're in power, and there isn't that that essence anymore.
Yeah, that's why when you look at so many Democratic countries, when you look at so many countries where the voters do have a choice between parties, you see a constant left-right pendulum. And there are very few Democratic countries where the winners, be it a president or be it a party, if it's parliamentary, there are very few countries where it's always middle of the road. It goes left to right to left to right to left. And that's because the voters are morons. Most people are stupid. Most people are not bright. And so they're unsatisfied. The left says, vote for us in our socialism, and we'll make you so happy. Yay! 8 years later, boo, right comes in. Vote for us in our nationalism, and we'll make you happy. Yay! 8 years later, they're still unsatisfied. People look to politics for self-improvement.
Well, the thing you mentioned in this article, well, you mentioned your background in the Tea Party. And the Tea Party presented themselves as an anti-establishment movement, but they were getting a lot of major backing from the big money behind the GOP establishment, including the Koch brothers. The thing about whole sort of a national populist movement, which initially backed Trump, the problem is they basically have the left opposed to them, the GOP establishment opposed to them, and all the corporate interests. So they have nothing, basically no influential entity backing them or sympathetic to them whatsoever.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think most people, I don't want to speak for Ann Coulter, but I think most people at this point are just kissing the immigration aspect of the Trump platform goodbye. I mean, it's not going to happen. We're going to keep getting the illegals. The piece I'm writing right now, that should be out in about a week or so, maybe 2 weeks, which has to do with asylum seekers. That decision by the judge 4 days ago in San Francisco, who even cares anymore? Because it just doesn't seem like anyone's heart is in the immigration issue anymore. And you, Robert, made this very good point about Yang in the piece that was in Tacky Mag about a week ago, where you spoke about how at this point there are probably people who are like, okay, I'm giving up on the Trump agenda. I might as well get $1,000 a month. I might as well go with Yang because Trump has proven to be a disappointment, and at least Yang does seem to be addressing my concerns and is offering me some relief. And so what the hell? And I think that's where Yang is going to be drawing a lot of his base from.
Absolutely. That's the general tone of the memes about Andrew Yang.
Yeah, all these people who are supporting him, like the Trump to Yang voters, they've pretty much given up on, well, at least immigration as their primary concern. And as you said, a lot of cases, it's not even a political ideology. If this country is over anyway, I might as well get my $1,000 a month. But what's interesting
there's also the hope that a universal basic income would change the dynamic in such a way that neo-tribalism of sorts.
We talked about that. People giving up on Americanism and moving more towards a neo-tribal paradigm. What's interesting about this whole concept of the right wing is You have people, you're kind of standard conservatives who would be closer to the far right, or maybe the libertarian right in the political compass. And then this whole demographic that includes the alt-right, I guess the alt-right to some degree, Trump's original populist supporters, and even someone like Tucker Carlson, a lot of those people, and all the Trump to Yang supporters, a lot of those people would actually show up more on the center, on the political compass, and you see that on those political compass memes that are getting posted.
I mean, that was Trump's success, is that he did appeal to people across a spectrum, especially white voters across the spectrum, but he's losing them. And I don't know to what extent, again, I'm kind of going back to something I said a little while ago, which is Trump's not going to win 2020. The Democrats can lose it, which is a big, big difference. I just don't think they're going to run anyone of value. However, if Trump thinks that, and I just, it's almost like I can see his, that smug face of his, just in his, in the Oval Office, thinking that as long as these numbers are good, these unemployment numbers are good, I'm a shoo-in. And that's a horrible mistake for any president to make. And just the same way that it was a horrible mistake for Bush Sr. to say that just because he won the Gulf War and exercised the ghosts of Vietnam, that somehow he was a shoo-in. The minute you get smug like that, you're already on the path to defeat. But again, the Democrats right now, they just have a whole fat load of nothing. Yang is offering something. Yang could be the younger Asian Sanders in a way, in that if he could just catch fire with the young activists the way that Sanders did. I'm imagining a Sanders-Yang ticket.
Yeah, I don't know if they get along necessarily, though.
Oh, they probably don't. But I mean, they probably don't. But history is filled with tickets like Eisenhower and Nixon. And they hated each other, despised each other. Eisenhower once said of Nixon that he was the most dishonest man he's ever known. Reagan did not like Bush. History's filled with those kinds of things, where a ticket with two people who are radically different. I mean, a lot of folks, you know, I'm such an old man at this point. A lot of people don't remember that during the Republican primary in 1980, it was Bush Sr. who coined the term voodoo economics as a slam against Reagan.
Yeah, there are a lot, this is kind of off topic, but there's a lot of interesting, like, we remember history, you know, based on the way things kind of turned out, but there's often enmity between people who later became friends. I'm thinking of, I've learned a little bit recently about Trump's 2000 presidential campaign, where he repeatedly called Pat Buchanan a neo-Nazi.
Oh, yeah, I remember ironic, that. That was the Reform Party. He said, Trump said, I don't want to be in a party with Buchanan as a nominee and, like, David Duke as a supporter. Yeah. I remember that. And, yeah, you see that now a lot of the never-Trumpers are actually, not all of them, of course, but some of them are actually warming up to Trump.
Because Trump has proven that he's a weakling on the things that he ran on, the things that the establishment was against. The establishment wants illegal immigration. The establishment does not want even a glimmer of white nationalism, or something that can be taken as white nationalism, even that if that's not how it's intended. The establishment is very happy. Trump is your typical low taxes, big business Republican. He's really not doing anything offensive other than tweeting. And there are so many of his supporters who still go by his tweets as though that's policy. Oh, look at what Trump just tweeted today.
Well, I think that's the crux of the issue, is that Trump, even still, and definitely leading up to last year's elections, he still talks a big game. He just does very little. Yeah. So even leading up to 2020, I don't think he'll solely rely on the economy. I think he'll make some kind of nativist claims, and I just think they'll be empty.
Well, maybe. I mean, he's so unpredictable in terms of his tweets. who knows what he's going to. He loves it when his people respond well to one of his, like, ooh, he went there. Like, oh, no, you didn't. No, you didn't, Trump. And his people love that. But is that really going to work in Florida and Ohio? We're living in times where most elections now come down to a very small number of states. And these states are not always easy to gauge. Hillary thought she had the swing states wrapped up. She didn't even campaign there as much as her people wanted her to, because she thought, oh no, I got all these states. They're all mine. These voters, I mean, I always think it's kind of funny because I don't live in a swing state myself. I live in California. California's one party rule, and we get our asses kicked by Democrats, but who gives a shit, because you can have an abortion literally as the baby's coming out of the womb. You can rip the head off. We love abortion so much in this state. I had a column like 2 or 3 years ago where I said California's flag should not be a bear, but abortion forceps. Because that's all that people care about in this state. We were pro-choice legal abortion before Roe versus Wade. It is set in stone here. But at least we have a point of view. I just find it funny, these states like Ohio, where it seems like every 4 years, these fuckers are like, how do I feel today? Do I feel a little left? Do I feel a little right? No, you fuckers, just make your mind up. You know, why do we have to revisit Ohio every 4 years and wait for you morons to read the paper and decide how you're feeling about each ideology, each party? Make up your fucking mind.
It really is an oddity of American politics, I would say. And also with the campaigning they're doing, like the states that have the first primaries get so much attention every 4 years, like Iowa, New Hampshire, the Democrats are trying to win. It really just weights the political perspective of people who live in certain states so much.
Yeah.
David, you wrote this article for Takia, Racial Dystopia, and you start off with some of the themes in apocalypse films, so you reference some critic who was complaining that the themes of classism and sexism flourish, but that they downplay racism.
I mean, that's an interesting quirk in apocalyptic, futuristic movies. so many themes are done to death in those movies. The rich oppressing the poor, people struggling over natural resources, fighting over oil, fighting over something of value. But race never seems to matter in these kind of futuristic movies. Yet, I would think that if the world ever just kind of ground to a halt, to the extent that like money doesn't matter, banks don't exist anymore, there's no international financial order, we would become more tribal. What is more innate than how we look? That's the one thing that's not going to change. You can destroy the international banking system. You can take the value out of gold and silver. You can eliminate Bitcoin with the stroke of one computer virus. But we're always going to look black or white, brown.
That's kind of kind of what Yang is saying? That's why we need our Yang bucks, because if everyone's job is automated, we're all going to turn on each other.
Well, that's far away. I mean, you know, when I was writing that article, I'm writing about futuristic scenarios. I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. But what I get into in the piece that you're referencing is if you look at post-apartheid South Africa, current day South Africa, that's as close as we're getting right now to an apocalyptic racial situation. All the other white colonies in Africa, the whites fled. except for a tiny few in Zimbabwe who stayed, tried to be farmers, tried to help fucking feed people, and they get slaughtered. But generally, the whites and the Indians who the British brought with them fled or were kicked out, as in Uganda. South Africa is a glimpse of the racial apocalypse. The formerly very prosperous society, yet a society that was prosperous on the backs of black people who did not have full rights in their own country. So I'm certainly not defending apartheid era South Africa. But now what we're seeing with things reversed, the white minority is getting the shit kicked out of it. And one of the few things that it has to play upon is the attractiveness of white people. And in the case of the article I wrote, which is an icky article, this is an article that you cannot read and not want to take a shower afterwards, because it mainly touches upon how some white South Africans are exploiting the attractiveness of white children to pedophiles, and they're exploiting that for money. Yeah, it is a terrible thing, and I think I'm the first columnist.
Yeah, you said you learned about it on Reddit, right?
Oh, yeah. I've never, because I don't think that story's been discussed on any major news site. Only Tacky is the only one.
No one else, just me. I was in a Reddit, I was just monitoring. I wasn't participating, but I was monitoring a Reddit exchange among white South Africans about the steady degradation of white South Africa. And I was fascinated by this. A lot of these Reddit forums are just worthless, but this one I was kind of sticking with and reading continually, because they were not so much talking about whites being killed by blacks. You can read about that elsewhere. That's not something that you have to go to Reddit for. But they were more talking about how as whites become poorer, as the formerly affluent South African whites become worse off, how they are contributing to their own degradation by doing some really icky things. Now, that includes selling their daughters to prostitution, but that's been covered elsewhere. There was a BBC documentary about white girls in South Africa who sell their bodies on the street because they live in these shanty towns that are now occupied by whites, formerly occupied by blacks.
With the whole, like, white proletariat, we have, like, a white proletariat in this country in some cases. Things have gotten a lot worse recently, but in some cases they've been kind of descended from the lower classes going back to colonial times. But the people you're talking to, do you have a basic idea if they're from the traditional proletariat, or in some cases were they prosperous and they had their lives destroyed through anti-white policies?
You mean the South Africans?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like this. Imagine if maybe you're not that bright, maybe you're not that skilled, but you're living in a society where jobs kind of have to hire you, where you don't get competition from other races. Keep in mind that during apartheid South Africa, it wasn't just blacks, straight out blacks, who were prevented from getting certain jobs or living in certain places. There were also lesser but similar restrictions for people of Indian ancestry, people who were brown. They were not subjected to as bad as the blacks, but still they were subjected to restrictions. So imagine being marginally gifted, marginally talented, but you're living in a society where there's no competition, and it's easy for you to get a job. Now, imagine that society changes overnight, and now not only is there competition, but there is a political incentive to bring in people who are not your type. Here you are, Mr. Marginally Intelligent, Marginally Talented Afrikaner, and now you've got to fight for a job that your employer is kind of being pressured to give to a black guy. So you've got to be really fucking good to keep that job. You cannot be marginal to keep that job. So a lot of these whites who are now finding themselves in shanty towns on the fringes of South African society, even in a big city like Johannesburg, and they're on the fringes, it's not that they've always been poor or outcasts. It is that they were not, they didn't have enough worth, value, to survive the end of apartheid. The minute that, because there's still, unemployment is not rampant among whites. Whites still have lots and lots of jobs, but they got to be good at them.
So they are still pretty overrepresented among the wealthy.
Oh yeah, I mean, and the blacks play on that. Every election, the more radical black parties will continually play on that, saying, but there are still too many whites in the media, too many whites in government, too many whites in finance, because
sounds
there
familiar.
Are.
Yeah.
And it, but it's true. Yes, South Africa is not yet ready to go full Mugabe. When you go full Mugabe is when you say, get rid of the whites, even if they are feeding us, even if they are keeping us safe and healthy. South Africa is not ready to do that yet. It is a hellish country, but yet it has not taken that final step of saying, get the fuck out, whites, even if it's going to kill us. The blacks in charge are smart enough to know there are certain things. We got to keep whites around for these things. Medicine and money and general things like that. Engineering, things like that. So whites are still overrepresented. But if you're not good at what you do, if you're not really good at what you do and you're white, fuck off. You're not, you're going to be living in a tin shack.
You're starting to kind of see that trend in this country where it's either, you either kind of make it to the very top or you get cast aside.
Yeah, more and more. I mean, certainly ever since affirmative action in the workplace started, you've got to be, and same with Asians. Asians have to be really, really good. Then they get too good and they get quoted, get anti-quoted because they're too good. But certainly for a white guy, you've got to prove your value, because a lot of businesses, especially businesses that have government contracts or that take government money, a lot of businesses have an incentive to hire blacks and browns. So in order for this business to keep you as a white guy, you've got to really be worthy. You've got to be worthy of that in order to keep your job.
You were working with some indie film director in South Africa.
I'm trying to remember. Did I say that in this podcast or in the article I wrote?
In the article.
It was a casting.
Oh, yeah, no, casting, not a direct casting. Yeah. I was helping to cast something here. Not in South Africa. I was helping to cast something here. And I kept getting applicants, these beautiful, beautiful blonde girls from South Africa who were looking for any work that could allow them to move here. At first, the first 3-4 times, I thought, well, this is a fluke. And like 30 or 40 times more.
So he wasn't even intentionally auditioning actresses.
We were looking for LA talent, Robert. We were not casting abroad. We were not looking for anyone from Belgium or Russia or China or anywhere. We were casting locally, but these South African beauties monitor the local casting calls here in LA, and they jump on them because they're looking for... there's very few ways for a white South African to move here. I mean, here's another thing Trump didn't do. Grant them amnesty. I'd be all in favor of that. If you're going to grant amnesty, grant amnesty to white South Africans and let them move, let them take advantage of our generous amnesty program. I'd be in favor of that, entirely in favor, because these are some very skilled people. These are not MS-13 gang members. These are beautiful blondes. My God, bring him into my city. I'll house him. I'll house 10 of them at once. So we were low, and that's an interesting point when you bring up that we're not looking for international talent. We were not. We were looking for LA.
Yeah,
talent.
That kind of actually reminds me of that Ann Coulter statement where she said she wanted to base immigration policy like as a Tinder app.
Yeah, well, I start to get all these applicants sending me their photos and resumes and video reels from Cape Town, Johannesburg, and I'm thinking, wow, I emailed some of them. There were a couple who were good, very good actresses, and one I won't mention her name, but she's quite good. And I said, you know, we're a local production. I'm getting back to you as a courtesy because you're obviously a pro and you deserve the respect of being treated as a professional, but we're not paying to fly people over from South Africa, and we don't pay for hotels. We're in LA. We got more than enough actors that we need. We don't have to pay for travel expenses. And she said, no, I'll pay my way. I'll fly over. I'll pay for the hotel. Just give me work so I can get a work visa. That's desperation right there. That is a desperate person. If they're willing to fly themselves to LA from South Africa, put themselves up at a hotel just to be in a low-paying indie film just so they can get a work visa and stay here, that is your classic desperation right there. You cast for an indie film. This is something I've been doing since 1986. It was my first job in the business. I still do it when I need money. So, of course, I'm doing it now that I'm in a position where I could use some extra money. You get a mixed bag. I mean, in terms of, forget the foreigners. You get an amazing amount of talent here in LA. But if you just look at the foreigners, the South Africans were quite good. The Australians are almost always great. I don't know what it is about the Aussies, but I've rarely gotten a bad applicant, actor or actress, man or woman. I've rarely gotten a bad one from Australia. Again, something in the water, maybe the dingoes eating the babies, whatever it is. They're terrific. The Russians always, always, always suck. Generally, the Eastern Europeans suck. Don't ask me why. Again, I mean, in Russian, I mean, here's my bias coming through, but I think just because the Russians are a brutal people and acting is all about nuance. The French get nuance. But then again, Australians are kind of brutal. I mean, not in a bad way, but they're base. They're like, I'm going to take a shit and have a beer, and then I'm going to just fuck me lady and have another beer. Yet they're great actors. I can't explain. This is one of those mysteries in the universe, guys, that I can't explain. So I'm not even going to try. If you're one of these lonely white guys who wants a white wife, you don't want to do the Asian thing. You don't want to do the Chinese.
But the thing is, I've actually never once heard of that scenario. It's usually either Asian, Russian, or sometimes maybe like South American.
No, but that's my point. They go for Russians because the Russian women are the one out there soliciting it. And the point I made in my article was, if you are a white guy looking for a white bride, stop messing around with the Russians. They are just gonna screw you in the ass with a broken wine bottle. Go to South Africa. Put yourself on some South African dating sites. There's all these beautiful blonde women who want any reason to live here and not there. So that was kind of the point I was making. And Coulter was kind of playing on that same thing, which is the South Africans, there's all these beautiful women that just want to get out, but they're nicer and prettier than the Russians. But they just don't have, you know, the same way that Nigerians all do that internet scamming thing for some reason, it's part of the culture. Same in Russian. Women do the mail order bride shtick. It's part of the culture. South Africans haven't learned to do that yet. I think if they started doing that, there could be thousands of South African women, white South African women, who could find a home here with lonely trad right nerds. Here is my South African trad right bride. The white girls were pretty, real pretty. And they would have an easier time coming here if instead of looking for work, they just started looking for dudes.
Yeah, I mean, surprised there's not some kind of, like, surprised no one thought of that.
Well, and that was why Coulter made that joke, because...
Yeah, you know, I think she, I do remember her saying that in some, I forget the context, so you gave her the idea.
Yeah, yes, because she and I were talking about that one night, and I gave her the inspiration for that line. That's the easiest way for South Africans, at least female South Africans, to flee, is there are so many guys in this country who will sponsor them and marry them.
David, you wrote this Golem article, and it was a reaction to Ilhan Omar.
This Golem piece that ran 2 weeks ago, and Ann Coulter tweeted it 4 times in the space of one day, and it's doing great. However, just yesterday, David Duke devoted an entire hour on his podcast to deconstructing the piece. And, you know, I've never had anything to do with David Duke. I never would have anything to do with David Duke. But my God, it's just so funny hearing him go on and on and on about the Hugh David Cole, and that's why I don't ever try to do anything where I can be fired for my reputation, because Jesus, once David Duke says something good about you, and I don't want him to say anything good about me, and I don't care, but this is where you say, you just call your boss and you say, well, nice knowing you. I'm going to be leaving work and never coming back, because David Duke devoted an entire hour to my piece.
Yeah, I guess we're running short on time, but I'll make one kind of brief point about that article. Is you make an interesting point, is that a lot of the people criticizing Ilhan Omar for her anti-Israel or anti-Semitic comments are the same people who support the kind of immigration policy that got her elected. Would you say that's your main point in the article?
Yeah, not just got her elected, that got her there. You know, I'm not as anti-Mexican immigration as some of the people who are my friends, some of the people I travel with. Mexico is our border. It's our neighbor state. And there's always going to be cross-border traffic. There will always be Mexicans in California, and there have always been Mexicans in California. Look at the names of our streets. Look at the names of our historic buildings and missions, Spanish and Mexican. But there's no reason for 100,000 Somalis to be in Michigan and the Dakotas. There's no reason for it, for the Somalis to be in Michigan, Minnesota, the Dakotas. That's artificial. That is not natural immigration. That is not a natural immigration pattern. Somalis, number one, don't usually live in snowy, cold climates. It is unnatural in every way. It's engineered. So the very fact this Ilhan Omar is even in her district, the very fact she's even there, the very fact that there are 100,000 Somalis in Minnesota, Michigan, the Dakotas, and some in Maine, even colder. Like, where can we put in that's even colder than Minnesota? Hey, how about Maine? It's completely, completely unnatural. Mexicans are always going to be in our Southwest. Chinese, Japanese came to California because that's where you sail to. That's the nearest point. Somalis have no reason to be in the middle of our country. So, my point was that many of the very same people who engineered having all of these Somalis, all these Somali Muslims, in places like Minnesota, in places like Fargo, and elsewhere in that region, they're the same people who are now angry that it's someone like Omar got elected and is attacking Jews, attacking Israel. Well, too bad, fuckers. You brought her here. You own her. Get used to it.
You're talking about the Jewish angle in particular, or just the entire American establishment?
I'm talking about leftist Jews. Talk about Democrat leftist Jews, which politically is the majority of Jews. Most American Jews are Democrats. Most American Jews lean to the left. Most American Jews support these ridiculous population relocating policies. And again, I want to say I'm not applying this to the Mexican border. That is not engineered. That is natural. It's always natural that there's going to be cross-traffic on a border that big. What is unnatural is bringing Somalis into Fargo. That is completely unnatural. And the people who were behind that, who did that, just ended up creating a monster.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank David Cole for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Always a lot of fun, guys. Always a lot of fun.
Nice talking to you guys.